wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if by my horn I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know yet. Not sing, 'cause I know yet. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know. I'd know how it feels. I'd know how it feels to be free. Yeah, yeah. I'd know how it feels. Yes, I'd know. I'd know how it feels. How it feels to be free. Lord, Lord, Lord.
Well, here we are again. Once a week on Mondays, and still doing a show from home. We have a projection that sometime this spring and summer, we will have a studio. Anybody out there has $50,000 they want to give me personally? I mean, yeah, you could send some to PRN, but send it to me personally so I can rent a studio and install phone lines somewhere. You know, I don't have to sit in my living room and do this. However, I am in my living room, and in fact, it's kind of cozy. It just started raining here in New York City. It's a sprinkle right now, but could turn into a shower. Might even turn into a thunderstorm. It's that kind of day. It's been very humid and muggy all day long. So may turn into a thunderstorm. Be inside with this, with the rain coming down. It's not exactly rain on the roof, you know, that nice little sound. But since I live on the sixth floor of a 16th floor apartment building, but anyhow, I have a number of people who regularly contact me after I do a show, people who listen to the show live or when I do a podcast. But I would, since I'm not talking to anybody right now, I'm not in a radio studio, so I don't see an engineer and I don't see anybody's even picture on Skype when I'm doing this by Skype. It would be nice, actually, and I'm not taking calls right now, although I suppose I could figure out a way to take calls if people wanted to call up, but I haven't really gotten to that yet. It would be nice to hear from people aside from the regulars, you know. I see somebody else send me an email. If you want to get in touch with me, and I hope you do, about any show you hear, any comments you have on any show I do on The Turning Point, go to my website, FederFiles, FederFiles.com, FederFiles, and FederFiles.com, and let me know that you heard the show and that you are listening. It makes a difference to me because otherwise I feel like I'm broadcasting in a vacuum somewhere or from outer space. So the other day, I decided to take a trip to a museum to take pictures. get my camera out now that it's spring, walk around the city, use something I used to love to do a lot, and I still do when I get the chance. So I get my camera, and I figure I'd go to a museum and take some pictures. You know, you call up the museums in advance, find out what the rules are. Can you take pictures at all? Do you have to take pictures without the flash on? Usually what they tell you is, yes, you can take pictures, but don't put the flash on. It disturbs the other patrons of the museum. So I decided to go to a place. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which is up near Columbia University. About two blocks from Central Park, three long blocks actually from Central Park. But I lived near northern boundary of Central Park. And I decided to go to the closest museum I could find, which is the Museum of the City of New York. Now, I don't know if the Museum of the City of New York is actually owned and run by the City of New York. I think it is, actually. I think that it's called the Museum of the City of New York, or Museum of the City of New York. And it's on Fifth Avenue, which is exactly the other side of the park from me. Central Park West is on the western boundary. Central Park West is on the western boundary, the road, the street on the western boundary of the park. Then there's Central Park North, and then there's Central Park South. And the eastern boundary of Central Park, which is a huge park, by the way, if you've ever been there, some of you come from out of the city. I know a lot of you are in the city. A gigantic park planned by a man named Frederick Law Olmsted, who was clearly a genius. The entire park is landscaped, absolutely, completely landscaped. Boulders that were there, the trees that were there that he thought should stay there, and then he planted trees from different parts of the world there. He added boulders, he built up land, and it's as if he had a godlike view. I mean, very few people could ever achieve a thing like this. It's an absolutely incredible park when you look at it from the side. I suppose if you fly over it, which I have never done in a helicopter, and it's not likely I will. Anyhow, so I decided to go to the Museum of the City of New York, and to get there, we have to take a bus from where I am, which goes goes across the northern part of the park. It's only about 8 blocks long, 9 blocks. The park is not very wide. It's wide enough. But it's not super wide. It's very long, is what it is. It's a couple of miles long, and maybe a half a mile, probably half a mile or 3/4 of a mile wide. But this bus goes across the northern part of the park, on the very southern edge of Harlem, and I went on the bus with my friend. The two of us decided to take a trip and take a look. And Harlem, you know, Harlem, if I say Harlem, it means different things to different people, depending on who's listening, how old you are, what you know about history, whether you live in New York City. So as the bus goes along the northern part of the park, the very southern part, Central Park North, the street, is the very southern part of Harlem. And up until about 10 or 15 years ago, I'm going to say about 10 years ago, maybe 15, when it started to gentrify the park, it was Harlem. And although there were lots of gorgeous apartment buildings, originally the southern part, the northern part of the park, to the apartment buildings that they built in the southern part of Harlem were considered, you know, as they should be, like they are on Fifth Avenue and Central Park West. The apartment buildings there have a view of the park, which is a much desired view to have from your apartment window, to be able to look out and see the park instead of more brick and steel and glass, right? And to see this park, this beautiful park, green or covered with snow or the leaves changing. And so originally the apartment buildings that were built, and I don't know when this was, 1890s, 1900, 1910, something like that. These apartment buildings were built and rich people lived there. Usually rich black people lived there. And because this was a time when Harlem in the 1920s, I guess, 1920s or 30s, was becoming almost entirely black. For a long time it had been When you go back far enough, it was Italians, it was Jews. But then later on, it became the famous Harlem that you think of when I say, just say the word Harlem. And it became a place for black people to live. And most of it was a place that was poverty stricken, except for certain parts of it. There were absolutely beautiful buildings near the top of the park. Anywhere in the city, in any city, I guess, but in New York City, the closer you get to the park, the more desirable it was. But then later on in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, even these apartment buildings and some of the other buildings on the southern part of Harlem, the very northern part of Central Park, became run down, and even they became poverty stricken. But in the last 10 or 15 years, like a lot of other areas in New York City, the poor people were just moved out by the landlords. They were moved out. Who knows where they have gone, how they have fared, we don't know. Moved to other boroughs in New York City, moved outside of New York City. Poverty is transferable, and nobody cares. Nobody much cares in society. Although some people work hard to eradicate it, and some people work with people who are in poverty, these people obviously have less rights than anybody else, especially being black. And so over the last 10 or 15 years, since there's so few places to live in New York City, the occupancy rate is so tight, there's not a lot of available apartments. Landlords have always owned and run New York City. Landlords, New York City is money city. And to be a landlord in New York City is to have automatically ownership in the city. Everybody else is just sort of sitting here. You know, there's a lot of rich people who aren't landlords who can afford to buy these extraordinarily expensive condominiums, or some of the richest people in the world, certainly the richest people in New York, in the United States, live in New York City. In like, there's one guy, I forget, has a 34-room, is it a condominium or a co-op? I always forget the difference. I don't know what the difference is. Condominium or a co-op. 34 rooms, 3 floors on Park Avenue. 3 floors. Of course, what do you think he is? He's the head of a hedge fund. Of course he is. Anyhow, a lot of people moved into the city, whites from other places, and whites from New York City who were upwardly mobile. And they were young lawyers. They all were and are young lawyers, investment bankers, people involved in the internet revolution, and you know, the Silicon Alley, whatever it's called in New York City, revolution. People with a good amount of money, because the rents they charged. What happened was, a lot of the original beautiful old brownstones in Harlem, and especially a lot of these buildings on the southern part of Harlem, have been redeveloped and renovated, and now are being sold as condominiums or co-ops. And they are bringing huge prices, and the people in Harlem, the poor people, the black people in Harlem, are squeezed tighter together or moved right out and into other places. So we go across the top of the park, and one of the ways you can tell us is if like 20 years ago I took this bus across the top of the park, almost everybody who got on the bus along the route of the top of the park, and then when it made the curve to go down Fifth Avenue at 110th Street and Fifth Avenue to go down Fifth Avenue, almost everybody, if not everybody who got on the bus, would be black. And lower middle class, lower class, if you use class words, middle class, right? Now, it's something like 25 or 30% of the people who get on the bus are white. And you can see the extraordinary change in the way the place has been gentrified. So my friend and I took this bus across the top of the park, and we made the turn at Fifth Avenue. Fifth Avenue is, of course, a very, all the way down to the bottom of the park, which is at 59th Street in Manhattan. And it's from 110th to 59th Street. And Fifth Avenue is, there's a place called Museum Mile. There's the Jewish Museum, there's the Guggenheim Museum, There is the Frick Museum. There's like about 12 museums up and down Fifth Avenue. There's also hospitals, some huge hospitals up and down Fifth Avenue, and the buildings, the apartment buildings there, are usually occupied by very, very wealthy people. So used to be that when you made the journey across the top of the park, it would be, black people with not too much money. Now it's black and white, and the white people have more money who live in Southern Harlem. And then you make the right turn and go straight down one of those things about New York City that neighborhoods change. As soon as you made that right turn at the top right corner of the park, you used to go from poverty to riches. So now it's more ameliorated. But anyhow, still, some of the richest people in New York live on Park Avenue. And then one or two blocks over, there's something called Madison Avenue and then Park Avenue, which is famous for the dwellings of rich people. So we went across the top of the park, and this odd class and color mix gets on the bus. And, we come down Fifth Avenue, and the museum building, which is this beautiful old museum, beautiful old building. I don't know if it was built that way a long time ago by the city of New York or whoever built this museum, or like a lot of museums in New York City, it was the mansion of somebody who was extraordinarily wealthy during the Gilded Age in New York City. A lot of the mansions on Fifth Avenue have turned into museums. And these are, I'm talking about, not just, McMansions like you might see in a upper middle class or upper class suburbs. I'm talking about, people who had the most money in the entire country. People like, J.P. Morgan, although his mansion wasn't there. These are places that occupy half of a city block or a third of a city block. They're gigantic. They have Greek pillars. They have, 40 rooms, 50 rooms, huge entrance halls. They have fountains in the middle. They're like Roman villas, these places, or Roman palaces, extraordinary places. A lot of them later on became museums, and some of them became embassies for foreign countries, embassies to the United States or consulates. So we get off and we go into this beautiful old building, marble everywhere, right? And we go to the admission desk to pay our fee. And the admissions to museums, I don't know how it is where you are, but the admission to museums, these wonderful and perhaps necessary repositories of history of all kinds, goes up and up and up. I don't even know who can afford to get into a museum anymore. It's so expensive. However, I'm lucky because I'm a senior. I'm in my golden years. God help me. So we go there, and it says on the website, when you go to the museum's website, or if you call up, it says, with identification, you can get a senior ticket, which is half price. Well, I don't need any ID. I don't need no stinking badges. I didn't have to show, nor did my friend. Never thought I'd be this old, but I am this old now. I mean, 70 years old, if I make it on June 16th, along with a couple of childhood friends of mine who grew up in my neighborhood had the same birthday as me. And one of my good friends right now has the same birthday as me. So if you're on Facebook, maybe you'll see it. I don't know. So we're paying senior admission, but it always makes me feel old or older than I am, or certainly older than I want to be. Obviously, I have not made the adjustment to the chronological and spiritual ebb and flow of life and death. So I'm old, so what? But being old is no joke, unless you age very well. I mean, we're not all Gary Null, and God bless him, we can't all age that well. But he would advise that we could try. And I have friends who are my age who certainly don't fetch as much as I do and are in generally better health than I am, although my health is not all that bad. So I get my senior admission, and, I said, Okay, yes. So the woman at the desk there is she's about 50 years old, and she says, "Two senior admissions?" And I say, "Yes, yes, two senior admissions." I remember when I was a kid, I used to look at old people and think, "Oh man, look at that baggy skin and those wrinkles and those spots all over their hands. It's disgusting, right?" And here I am. Although I'm not in such bad shape as that, but still, you know how it is when you're a kid sometimes, and you look at old people and you say, "Oh man, that'll never be me. I mean, look at that. They were like a foreign race, like from outer space or something like that. You'll never be like that, right?" Anyhow, so senior admission, I get my senior admission badge, my sticker badge. And you have to put a sticker on to show that you paid. You can't be walking around the museum and there are museum guards there. Otherwise, you might have walked in and not paid, right? So we paid our cheap price to get in, and they gave us this sticker. And I just dislike stickers, name tags. Anytime I ever went to a convention or something like that, I can't stand having stickers or name tags around me. But that's the way it is everywhere these days. Everywhere you go, sometimes because of what happened in 9/11. Everybody is wearing a badge or something around their neck, some plastic identification. And I'm wearing a sticker, and there it is. You put the sticker on your shirt. "Hi, I'm Mike. I'm a senior." And "Hi, Mike. Would you like us to carry you up the stairs?" No, fortunately, they have elevators. So we walk around this building. And it's a big, old, beautiful building. Like I said, I don't know if it's owned by the city of New York or whether it was built specifically as a museum, or it could have been somebody's mansion once, and then it's all subdivided into, various rooms. And they have all sorts of exhibits. They have exhibits on old landmarks in the city and exhibits on the hip-hop revolution in New York. Once they had an exhibit on graffiti. There's some interesting things. And I'm taking pictures here and there of something that's interesting that strikes my camera eye. And we get to the third floor, and they have paintings of a bygone New York, actual, oil paintings from the 19th century and from the 18th century of New York. And a lot of these are really extraordinary, beautiful oil paintings of scenes in New York, scenes from different boroughs of New York, winter in New York in 1821, just beautiful. And then portraits of different fire departments going to put out a fire. They had competing fire departments in New York City up until the 1880s or 90s when they consolidated into one place. If you've ever seen the movie Gangs of New York, you can see that at work, that they had two fire departments, which were, is filled with corruption in New York City, even worse than it is now, and much worse, as bad as it is now, right? And the fire departments, these two competing fire departments, were part of two political clubs, would show up and they would get into pitched battles while the fire was going on as to who was going to put the fire out, because sometimes there was looting involved, and sometimes it was a matter of pride, and it was pure macho insanity. And they would get into fist fights, and sometimes worse. People would get shot between these two fire departments as to who was going to put out the fire. Really crazy stuff. Anyhow, there was a great painting of a fire in New York, and the fire department came to put it out. It was in 1860, and then there was pictures of the docks a long time ago when it was all these huge sailing ships. And I took some great pictures there. And then there was an exhibit in a small separate room called Gilded Age. Gilded Age. And it was sponsored by the Tiffany Foundation. And we walk into this room, and it was full of portraits of mostly women and family portraits of the rich from the Gilded Age, which is roughly the 1880s to around 1910 or something like that, when you had all the robber barons and this extraordinary talk about inequality, income inequality, and wealth inequality. This was the height of it, except for now when it's being repeated again, right? But this was the height of it when you had miners, working 7 days a week, owning their whole lives, and dying young and dying in unsafe mines. for the enrichment, and children working everywhere, and garment factories where young women were killed or suffocated or died in fires. And people, you know, most of the country, you know, building railroads or working in mines or working in clothing factories for the enrichment of a very, very few people. And these were the robber barons, people like J.P. Morgan and other people. So this room was dedicated to the Gilded Age. And it was extraordinary. There was a bust of some very famous, very rich man. There were these beautiful oil portraits done by, you know, society oil painters, I guess. And they had all kinds of beautiful things in there. I mean, sponsored by Tiffany. There was all sorts of Tiffany jewelry, old, beautiful examples of old pocket knives with jewels on them, and canes with ivory heads, and hidden compartments, and studded with jewelry, with gems. There were these gorgeous and beautiful, sometimes even outlandish, hats that women wore in those days, feather hats. There was silver tea sets and gigantic porcelain, beautiful porcelain vases that were made over in France or by famous American, you know, artists. And like I say, gold dinner plates and silver tea sets. This is how, you know, portraits of how the rich live. And there were these, a couple of portraits of these beautiful young women. And they had this typical look. They had these beautiful dresses on and gorgeous jewelry. And they had that rich look, that kind of slightly distant, slightly arrogant, but slightly distant, special rich look, you know, that you could tell from certain people. And it's like something from an Edith Wharton novel. Picture the young women in an Edith Wharton novel going to a ball or getting dressed for a ball or, you know, having their coming out party or whatever it was called. Their debut, excuse me. Their debut. And the women all had these really narrow waists, these young women. And the women in these portraits, it's beautiful, oil paintings, absolutely beautiful. And I took some pictures. They had these impossibly narrow waists and these pushed up large pigeon-breasted bosoms, you know, just incredible. And these beautiful silk and lace dresses, absolutely beautiful. And there was a guard in there, you know, and to be a museum, the guards are standing around. What a job. That I'm thinking, what a job. The guards in there were Latino and black, most of them. And, you know, this is the job that they get, right? Whoever funds the museum or patronizes the museum, maybe that's a different story. And this is, you know, the gift shop with all kinds of things in it. But the guards are standing there. What a job to stand there all day long and just basically look at people. You don't really talk to people too much. In some museums, I suppose they don't encourage you to talk to people, but you could ask them questions. And there was one light-skinned black man who was the guard in the Gilded Age. So he's standing there looking like he's been through a lot in his life. I'd say he was sort of, you know, beat up looking, but, you know, he clearly had been through a lot. He had lived through a lot in his age, and who knows what he had seen. He came from the islands. He had a slight island accent. How do I know this? Because he came over when we were staring at a portrait of a young woman, and I was taking pictures of the portrait from different angles so there wasn't too much glare from the lights shining down on it. And she was an absolutely beautiful young woman, clearly a society woman. And the man comes over, and he, for our edification, me and my friend, he says, with a slight island lilt, you know, probably left over from when he was, you know, first came here 30 years ago. And that's the day guys have been in his early 50s. He says, you know, women in those days didn't have to go to work. They just wore fancy clothes. Sometimes they just changed their clothes four times a day. They went to teas and they went to charity balls. He said, not like now, not like now. He said, all they did, all they had to do was marry rich men. And they didn't have to go to work, and that's how their lives were. I think we'll take a little break now and go to the music. And I'm thinking, before we do that, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, that's all there was to it, right? These women, they just married rich men, and they lived beautiful lives ever, happily ever after. But read something like Edith Wharton or you know, some intelligent, wonderful novelist who writes about that period and see just how happy these women were to be kept like this and what it was like. A strange time. And yet I have this political feeling, of course, being in the political camp I am. I'm looking at these rich, you know, all this jewelry and these feathered hats. There were these incredible hats with huge ostrich feathers, and there was one whole bird, some exotic bird of paradise that was actually stuffed on top of a hat. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, all this was possible because people were dying in mines and dying in factories, dying in steel mills, so that these women could, you know, could live in these mansions and do and change dresses 4 times a day. But was it all that simple? Was it life that easy for these women? Let's hear a little music, then we'll come back.
The ballroom was filled with fashion's throng. It shone with a thousand lights. And there was a woman who passed along, the fairest of all the sights. A girl to her lover then softly sighed, there's riches at her command. But she married for wealth, not for love, he cried, though she lives in a seems to be. 'Tis sad when you think of her wasted life, for youth cannot mate with age, and her beauty was so.
Bird in a gilded cage. You know, it's very difficult to have any sympathy for these women. I mean, when you think about all the horrors of life of incredible poverty at a time when there was no government protection, when there were no unions, when nobody had any rights, when they could work people to death. And these women, had these lives of astounding luxury with 20, 30 servants, 40 servants, 50 servants, mansions in the country, mansions in the city. And they lived longer lives because, they weren't exposed to all the tenements and mines and everything else. Well, I suppose everybody's got their story, though. Everybody's got their story. But I got some good pictures. That's when I went there. I got some good pictures. And like I said before, a lot of these museums up and down Fifth Avenue, and a lot of museums probably in other cities too, but especially since that this is my city and this is what I know, a lot of the hospitals up and down the city, these gigantic hospitals, are built on the charity of rich people. These hospitals were originally built, and huge modern new wings, 20 stories high, are built on the donations of rich people. Some of them almost singular donations. There are people who are so rich that they gave like $100 million to build such a gigantic new cancer wing to a hospital right there on Fifth Avenue, or in different places in the city too. But right there on Fifth Avenue, there's a couple of huge hospitals, and the museums too. These museums that have these collections which belong to these rich men like J.P. Morgan, and there was a man named Frick, and I think his fortune came from steel mills from the 1890s. And J.P. Morgan, who was at one point the richest man in the world, and his fortune came from railroads and banking and every other piratical behavior that could possibly be. I mean, he was the worst of the robber barons. And but they're mansions, and where they house these giant collections, and they would go all over the world, these people, or send agents all over the world to get famous paintings, Rembrandts and Van Goghs, and just astounding paintings, and the most beautiful Fabergé eggs and Tiffany lamps, and these are the lamps they had in their house. But they would collect watches, gold with diamonds and emeralds on them, and all of their jewelry and all their paintings, including a lot of these things from the 20s and 30s, modern art, were because rich men and rich women established these museums. The Guggenheims were bankers in New York, and the Guggenheim Museum, which is filled with extraordinary paintings, and a lot of these places with sculpture and paintings, they are there as with the hospitals, because of great wealth. And the rich built these things for the masses. This was charity on their part. They wanted to, I don't know what their motivation was. Was it guilt? Was it something, noblesse oblige? This is what you did if you were rich. Did they have any religion at all? Did they feel like God wanted them to give back to the world? I don't know. But it was a thing to do also. It was a fashionable thing to do. To do charity work and to but and later on, some of them, I suppose, just got plain embarrassed by it all. And in the middle of a time when everybody understood what everybody else's poverty was like, with communications and newspapers and radio and TV, it was a bit much to be living in a 40-room Grecian style or Roman style mansion. Well, like 10 blocks away or 6 blocks away, who knows, people could barely live or barely be alive. But, and this is not an old thing either. This happens still all the time. Like I say, a former president of Citibank has contributed hundreds of millions of dollars, and I got his rich friend to contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to another huge New York City hospital, Sanford Weill, his name is, and it's called the Weill Cornell Medical Center. And David Koch, speaking of the evil rich, right? Like the evil dead, the evil rich, David Koch has contributed huge amounts of money to hospitals and to museums. He's given tens of millions of dollars to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And he just recently, they, and of course now these days it's fashionable to have your name on everything. It wasn't always that way. But now if you give, if things change somewhere, I don't know, we're in the 80s or 90s, that if you give all this money, there's nothing anonymous or charitable or a rich person's obligation. Well, maybe there is, but still, you get your name in huge letters, huge brass letters across the concrete or the marble on the outside. So David Koch, for a year, in front of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they dug the place up and they wrecked everything, and you had to go around, and you know, you had to go underneath things. And finally, they revealed that they built two new fountains with, you know, lined with marble, and it called a David Koch fountain. So this is the rich people doing for the masses. Anyhow, I always had trouble with museums, just museums in general. Every time I ever went to a museum, I used to get very tired. I would get tired in museums. There was something about museums, and I never could quite identify what it was. Maybe I know now, but even when I was a little kid, there was something, first of all, kind of claustrophobic for me. I didn't like being inside these places. But the museums themselves tire me out. Maybe it's the marble floors, but I don't know. I mean, people can walk through museums for half an hour, 2 hours, and they have benches in there because people get tired standing and walking, looking at the paintings, looking at everything else. But I always felt like hemmed in and claustrophobic about museums. It was a real problem for me. But when I think of museums, and then the other thing about museums, I guess, is that they are actually, just the very word, when you think of museum, it's something that's old, that's preserved. And when you're a little kid, I suppose, I liked the museums better when I was in my teens and 20s. But when you're a little kid, you want to be out running, you want to be out in the air, you want to be doing things, right? You don't want to be in a museum. But in New York City, they take school kids. You know, you can walk into a museum in New York City, even, you know, during the school year, during the school week, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids. They bring them to the museum because they're educational. And these days, of course, it's different because things are interactive, right? There are all kinds of, you know, interactive things. You press a button and there's a holograph of something else, or, you know, you can use, all kids know how to use computers, right? And so everybody is like getting information next to these. When I went to the museum when I was a kid, back a million years ago, along with the dinosaur exhibits in the museum, there was nothing you could, there was no button to press that told you what, or showed you with graphics and everything, what the age of the earth was. And I mean, it was all whatever the museum put in front of you, whatever explanations or exhibits is what you saw. And they would have written out plaques or written out, typed out, you know, cardboard explanations of what you were looking at. But there wasn't any of this interactive stuff, you know. So things are different these days. So it's probably more interesting and less claustrophobic and less fuddy-duddy. Museums, when I was a kid, always had that feeling to me of stuffiness. It was a stuffy, old feeling in a museum. When I think of museums, though, I often think of my father. I inevitably think of my father, because my father used to take me to the Museum of Natural History, the American Museum of Natural History. Now, I assume that probably everybody who's listening to me has been to the Museum of Natural History, the American Museum of Natural History, which is on Central Park West. And it's right next to the Hayden Planetarium. It is actually part of, the Hayden Planetarium is sort of part of the American Museum of Natural History. And you probably have been there. I was there a lot with my father. Now, my father, who I hardly ever saw, loved space. He loved anything that had to do with the natural world. He was a chemical engineer. And he knew everything about everything when it came to natural history and animals and also anything mechanical, rocket ships and fuel. We're talking about the 50s here, basically. And during the few times that he would show up from his trips around the world to some of these places where things were very much alive, you know, his trips to jungles to build mines, to build plants, fertilizer plants and bridges and dams all over the world and in swamps and in jungles and, you know, in mountains in foreign countries. He would show up back in, and he read. He was a voracious reader, and he read, went to City College, and he just was a very, very intelligent guy. And despite his big, rough demeanor, very intelligent guy, and he seemed to know everything, and he liked to take me to the Museum of Natural History, which was an absolutely fascinating place. Absolutely fascinating place if you've been there. And I loved that museum. I think I loved it because my father would take me there. It was one of the few places, like zoos, my father would take me. And I like zoos better, I think, because, you know, the animals were alive. And of course, he knew everything about the animals. He knew exactly what the animal was without looking at any plaque or identification. He knew what kind of snake that was coiled up in the corner, sealed up by a glass, because it was poisonous. He knew what every ape was. He knew absolutely everything about the museum. He knew everything about the zoo, about animals. And we went into the museum. We saw, fossils. They had these gigantic fossils. I don't know. I haven't been in the museum for like Museum of Natural History for like 20 years now. I mean, the last time I was in these museums was when I took my own kids there. The American Museum of Natural History is when I took my own kids there. And I used to take my son to see the Metropolitan Museum to see they had a room with armor in it, with old, beautiful examples of polished gold and silver and steel armor and weapons that knights use. And he was fascinated by that. And it was kind of exciting, right? I guess the other thing about museums that bothered me when I was a kid, and still bothers me a little bit, maybe more than a little bit, is although it's fascinating, it's something everybody should see, is like, the Metropolitan Museum has this Egyptian wing. There are these ancient statues, Roman and Greek statues and busts and heads, sometimes it's just the remains of them. And ancient Chinese statues, Buddhist statues and Confucian statues, beautiful old carved lacquer things from hundreds of years ago, and then Japanese armor. There are, I say, things that are really ancient, like, things that are 3,000, 4,000 years old, statues of gods. And first of all, a lot of them have been stolen. They were stolen by rich people, some of the same rich people in the 19th century and the early 20th century, who went over to these places and bribed people and basically just, had expeditions there with their, hundreds of millions of dollars and just took these things. Basically, the Elgin marbles, Lord Elgin from England. And they went over and took these things. And of course, as you see, you read in the paper all the time, it's a very active thing now that a lot of these countries are demanding that these things be returned to them, demanding these things be returned to them. And to the extent that there's any international cooperation, these things are being returned. A lot of these ancient statues, which are part of people's religions, which are part of people's cultural history going back, 500 or 1,000 or thousands of years, are being returned to them now. But to walk through the museum with my father was such a extraordinary, such a wonderful thing. And like I say, it was great to walk with him through the museum because if there was a fossil of a dinosaur, you could read about it. It's a gigantic fossil of a dinosaur. There was one that was scary, which was the fossil of an extinct ancient shark. And it was the jaws and the teeth. I don't know if they reconstructed the teeth, but it was the jaw and the wide open with the teeth. And this shark must have been 100 feet long. I'm exaggerating, but it must have been 60, 70 feet long. It was gigantic. And that's what the plaque at the bottom estimated it was. And they had it hanging up in the air. I mean, it haunted me for years afterwards. But then you see all this beautifully constructed fossils of the Tyrannosaurus, and of the Brontosaurus. Extraordinary the way they put them together. And but my father knew all these things. He would tell me, what the temperature was like in the swamps that they lived in, what kind of food they ate, and give me all the different theories why they were extinct. Of course, it's the same old thing. These museums would not exist without the charity and the donation of the very rich. So I don't know if there's no perfect society, but in a capitalist society and in our society, and I guess in museums and other parts of the world that are essentially capitalist societies or at best social democracies, the original museums, these gigantic, and a lot of the original hospitals were charity. They were donations from the rich. Like, for instance, in the Museum of Natural History, and this is one thing that was kind of creepy and fascinating at the same time. They had these beautiful dioramas in the Museum of Natural History. Dioramas in these glass enclosures, maybe about 12 feet tall and about 8-9 feet wide. They had pictures that they would say Southern Wilds, and there was, you know, they were actual, you know, embalmed or stuffed snakes, you know, wildcats, alligators, and they had the actual the foliage, the broad-leaved, swamp foliage, where they would have, the northern wilds, you know, and there was a lynx there, and they were beautifully preserved, and they looked like any moment they were going to be animated, and there was one with bighorn sheep, and you were looking down from their point of view, from the mountains, from the Rockies, and you were in these beautiful things, these dioramas, and yet I had this feeling at the same time that I was so fascinated by them. But at the same time, I'm thinking to myself, these animals were killed and put in here. They are dead. Now, a lot of city kids and a lot of people who live in cities will never get into the wild or never get to see one of these animals or one of these snakes or these incredibly beautiful birds. There was a diorama of a gigantic grizzly bear, you know, on his hind legs with his teeth bared. I presume his could be her teeth bared, and all these incredible things. And I saw them. I mean, I wasn't likely ever to see these things. I was going to be an explorer, and I wasn't a big traveler. So it was absolutely, there are millions and millions, tens of millions of city people and city children have seen these fantastic things that they would never see in nature or in the wild. And still, they were killed by people. And at the bottom of these dioramas, on the side of the dioramas, they had plaques, and it said, donated by, and it would give the name of the, you know, or donated by, and it would give the date, you know, Kenya, you know, there was, a diorama of a stalking tiger, or stalking, you know, a lion. And it would say donated by, in other words, killed by, like Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt's the gigantic statue outside the steps of the Museum of Natural History. And Theodore Roosevelt was a great killer of animals and a murderer of animals all over the world. You know, out in the American West, in Africa, in South America, places. And he donated, you know, a lot of his kills to the Museum of Natural History. And there's a big statue of him, so much as he identified with that. Theodore, and came from an extremely rich family, of course, one of the wealthiest families in the country. There's a picture of him, a sculpture of him, where he's riding high on a huge bronze horse, bronze sculpture, and next to him is a faithful Indian companion, right? And one of the exhibits they had, one of the dioramas, one of the exhibits they had was of an Indian shaman conducting a rite, a ritual, where somebody was lying down and the shaman was shaking his rattles. And I presume this was not an Indian that Theodore Roosevelt shot and had stuffed for the museum. But this is part of the irony of it all. A lot of these creatures were killed en masse by rich people and hunters. Some of them wound up in museums. But the irony of them all being killed, the contradiction of them all being killed by rich people and then stuffed and put in a museum for other people to see. So they're dead, but once they were alive in nature where they belong. In fact, there was one thing in the Museum of Natural History that was fascinating to me, was they had an absolute beautiful scale model, an Indian fishing village, right? Which long ago had been, by that time, had probably been destroyed. It was well on its way to being extinct by the white men, the Europeans, who took over this country. And yet they were reproduced it in the museum. So there was always this creepy feeling, right? Anyhow, I got some good pictures. Well, we left the museum. Finally, it was time to leave the museum. And we're walking back up to take the bus across southern Harlem back to the Upper West Side where I live. And right outside of this beautiful nature conservatory, this giant, beautiful garden in Central Park, there was all these very rich ladies, and they're wearing fancy dresses, and they're wearing these gigantic hats with feathers in them. And it almost looked like stuffed birds and feathers. And they were clearly, you know, they're rich. They were the East Side of New York, the Upper East Side ladies. They were very rich. And they were wearing these hats and these really fancy jewelry. And I, snapping away with my camera. And one of the women looked over at me and she said, this is for the benefit of the park, you know, as if she was feeling some guilt because they blocked it off. They had security guards. You couldn't get in, only these rich people who had admission tickets. And so things really don't change. I mean, these are the wives of bankers and hedge fund millionaires and lawyers and billionaires and lawyers. And they nothing is much different than the Gilded Age. This is the modern Gilded Age. And it's the same old thing. The rich, you know, giving charity to the rest of us. Is that the way that society will always be? Is that the way society will always be? I don't know. But this woman told me, you know, as if to tell me, you know, it's not just what it's not what it looks like. It's for the benefit of the park. Okay. For the benefit of the park, you have to stay out temporarily out of this beautiful garden because there's a charity ball here. And yet, the park wouldn't exist without the donations of rich people, nor would the hospital, which was practically right across the street, or the museum in the city of New York, or many other museums or hospitals. People in their millions owe their lives to the rich, and they owe a fascinating education from these museums to the rich. I think actually what I'd like to see is a museum with stuffed rich people sometimes. Anyhow, that's the way it is. And I got some good pictures, and that's what I came to get. So museums, hospitals, the rich, the poor. Is there some way we could ever balance society so it would be equal? I don't know. It would be nice. All right. I'll see you next week.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? It'd be a paradise and put up a fucking line. You took all the trees and put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them. No, no, no. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? Be a paradise and put up a fucking lie. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away your DDT. I don't care about spots on my apples. Leave me the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? To be a paradise and put up a fucking lie. Hey, now they pay. Listen late last night, I heard the screen door swing.